This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The World of All Souls, the complete guide to a discovery of witches, Shadow of Night, and the Book of Life by Deborah Harkness. Read for you by Saskia Marleveld, with Deborah Harkness, Steve West, and Jennifer Ikeda.
Dear reader, welcome, or welcome back, into a world of demons, humans, vampires, and witches, where a reluctant witch and a 1,500-year-old vampire discover the secrets left in a mysterious manuscript. When I started writing the books in 2008, I had no idea that so many readers around the globe would take Diana, Matthew, and all the other bishops and de Clermonts into their hearts and minds. Today, I share the creatures in the All Souls trilogy with readers from Australia to Vietnam and Finland to Brazil. This book is for all of you. My curious, engaged readers always have more questions than I can possibly answer on social media, via email, or at a book signing. We've written this book with you in mind. We delved into my file cabinets and notebooks. We mine the stories for hidden nuggets of arcane lore and historical information. We've transformed some of what was in my imagination when I wrote the trilogy into something that could be shared. As you explore the pages of this book, you'll discover a treasure trove of information about the creatures and events of the trilogy. This companion volume gives you a chance to have a good rummage through my inspiration archive. Though some of your questions will be answered, we hope that they are replaced with new insights and connections. And as you follow the threads through history, legend, music, magic, and science, we hope that you feel a new sense of affinity for the characters and stories. Enjoy your journey of discovery, or rediscovery, into the world of All Souls. Best wishes, Deborah.
In Conversation with Deborah Harkness. The Inspiration for All Souls. What drives your fascination with the past?
Ever since I was a small child, I loved history. My parents took us to historical sites when I was growing up outside of Philadelphia, and I loved dressing up in long skirts and imagining I lived in the 18th century. After my first trip to England to visit my mother's family in the 1970s, I fell in love with 15th and 16th century history, pushing further back into the past. I think those early experiences visiting historical places and reading about them before and after made history seem alive to me. I could imagine myself into colonial Williamsburg or the Revolutionary War or Warwick Castle or Speke Hall. Once the past was a living, breathing place in my imagination, it never lost its fascination for me. The more I read, the more important it was that I know why people in the past did what they did. I've always been interested in what motivated people and how the particular conditions of their lives and experiences shaped those desires.
What triggered you to turn from your work as an academic historian to writing a fictional tale of a witch, a vampire, and a lost manuscript?
At the start of a family vacation in Puerto Vallarta, I walked through the airport and saw a big display of books about witches and vampires. I had just finished a book about the history of scientific inquiry in Elizabethan London and had been reading virtually nothing published after 1610 for years. So this move into popular culture was something of a surprise to me. Looking at the jackets, I was struck with a couple of simple questions. If there really are witches and vampires, as these books suggested, what on earth do they do for a living, and why don't I know any of them? When I started writing the story, I really started by imagining a possible answer to those questions. I had spent 6 or 8 weeks on it and had 9 chapters completed before I even told anyone else that I was working on something strange. Though I hadn't seriously considered writing fiction since 10th grade, it appeared that I was writing a novel.
Could you outline the initial journey of the All Souls trilogy coming into the hands of readers? How did you get from the spark of an idea to a published book and the spread of the trilogy worldwide?
It took me about 9 months to complete the first full draft of the book. There was something very gestational about the process, and it was a big baby, more than 1,100 pages. It then took me 3 months, essentially my summer vacation from teaching, to carve 350 pages from it. I had a lot of help with that process from Lisa Haltinen, who's one of the collaborators on this book. After it was slightly more manageable in size, my agent Sam Stoloff put it out to potential publishers on a Thursday in September 2009. I got the news that Viking were interested after a class on Monday. I was sitting on a bicycle rack outside my lecture hall, and by the following Tuesday, they had purchased the book. That call came almost exactly a year after I started writing A Discovery of Witches. Many people told me this kind of thing never happens, and as far as I'm concerned, it's proof that there's always been more than a bit of pixie dust and magic surrounding the All Souls trilogy. It was surreal to have the book sell so quickly and so soon after I'd started the writing process. After that, Viking took the book to the International Book Fair in Frankfurt, Germany, where it sold to other publishers around the world. Happily, I was so busy working on the next book in the trilogy, Shadow of Night, and teaching my classes, that I had time to let it all sink in slowly. Otherwise, I think the sudden success might have been overwhelming, not to mention daunting.
The Writing of All Souls. As a professor of history and a person who juggles a wide range of interests, how do you balance writing with everything else in your life?
Sometimes balance just isn't possible. It's kind of a relief to say that. We all strive for it, and maybe it seems as if I've got some magic formula to achieve it, but actually, I have good days and bad days just like everybody else. As for my formula, it's changed from book to book. When I was working on A Discovery of Witches, writing fiction was a very small part of my life. I wrote for the first few hours every day from around 6 to 8 a.m., and then I did my full-time job at the university. Once A Discovery of Witches sold to the publisher, I became an author. Then I had 2 jobs, and I also had to find time to keep writing. That's when creativity was necessary. Shadow of Night, interestingly, was written almost entirely at night, from 10 p.m. to midnight after the hullabaloo of the day had all died down. I wrote the Book of Life whenever I could. Life was very hectic by then. Now, as I move into writing other books, some of them even about the bishops and de Clermonts, I'm trying to get back to the kind of routine I had with The Discovery of Witches. That's easier said than done, however. Everyone hearing this knows how hard it is to carve out quiet time for yourself and to give that time the same importance in your busy day as any other commitment. We always seem to shortchange ourselves in an effort to get everything else done. I try to get enough rest, enough exercise, and to eat properly, something we all need to do. At this point, I've learned that I really can't write for more than a few hours a day. I'm better with shorter, more focused writing stints. I can write almost anywhere, including my office at home, at the dining room table, in cafes, and my shared office space in town, on planes, in hotel rooms, and at libraries. Probably the weirdest spot I've ever written was in my car at a highway rest stop on the I-5 in California. I was getting away for a writing week, and I just had to pull over and put something on the page.
Because you'd been an academic writer for many years before you turned to fiction, what surprised or delighted or frustrated you most about writing a novel?
What surprised me most is that you're not in total control of your story, or at least I'm not. The characters seem to have a life of their own, and sometimes you just need to buckle your seatbelt and go along for the ride. This was brought home to me in the very first book when, with no plans or warning, Matthew got into the car, drove to Scotland, and Hamish opened the front door. I had not anticipated that. But who could now imagine a world without Hamish? I'm sometimes frustrated by how hard it is to get what I see and feel so clearly onto the page so that someone else can experience it. This is where it's vital to let other people who you trust read your work. We are never our own best editors. A writer always needs fresh eyes and a fresh perspective.
You've said previously that you wrote the last lines of the trilogy at the same time you wrote the first. Was it difficult to stick to this ending? Did you find the story pulling you in different directions as you got deeper into writing it?
I did know how the trilogy would end, though I ended up editing the words a bit, but I didn't know exactly how we would get there. The story was well thought out through the beginning of what would become the Book of Life. However, what came between the beginning and the ending did change. In part, that was because what I'd sketched out was too ambitious and complicated, the perils of being not only a first-time trilogy writer, but a first-time author as well. It also had to change because certain characters, namely Hamish and Gallowglass, weren't part of my initial cast of creatures. It was very important to me that I tied up the loose threads already present in the story so readers had a satisfying conclusion. Early in the writing of the Book of Life, it became clear that this wasn't going to give me much room to introduce new characters or plot twists, two things I dearly love to do, it turns out. I now understand why so many trilogies have 4, 5, 6 or more books in them. Finishing the trilogy as a trilogy required determination and a very thick pair of blinders, as I left behind characters and storylines that would take me too far from the central story of Diana, Matthew, and Ashmole 782.
How did the experiences of writing the three books compare? Which would you say was the easiest and which the most difficult?
When I began the trilogy, I thought I was writing a single book, three parts. Part one would be more of a love story with the two main protagonists developing their relationship. Part two would be more a work of historical fiction. And part three would be a work of science fiction with lots of thriller elements. No one was ever going to read it, or so I thought, and I thought it would be fun and interesting to play with different kinds of stories and writing. Once I hit page 400 of part one, I realized this was going to need to be more than one book. Nevertheless, I held on to the idea that each book in the trilogy would have a slightly different feel and tackle different writerly problems. I still didn't think anybody but me and my mother were ever going to read it. Because of their distinct characters, the books felt very different as I was writing them. A Discovery of Witches was all joy and fun. I was writing furiously fast, and the words seemed to just jump onto the page. The major stumbling block I came across occurred when Matthew left Diana at Set Tour to return to Oxford. That was a dark time in the writing process when I felt as if the characters had stalked off the page and gone on strike. They eventually came back, but it was scary. Shadow of Night was the most complicated to write, all those calendars. But it's the work that I'm most proud of because of the real history in it. The challenge in Shadow was making sure I hadn't done something for the sake of the story that violated the history. I'm a historian after all. The Book of Life was, without question, the most difficult to write. That's largely because the beginning was so tough. I had to draw two storylines together, and it took me 8 attempts. I wrote 8 different versions of the first 4 chapters before I got one that worked. It felt like trying to launch a jumbo jet with a rubber band.
How has the huge success of the trilogy and having so many readers changed the creative process for you?
When I wrote A Discovery of Witches, and even the first half of Shadow of Night, the only person I had to please was myself. There were 0 expectations and no deadline pressure. All of that changed in a wonderful way in 2011 with the success of the first book. Since then, I sometimes just have to step away from social media and book events so that I can focus on the stories and the characters and let everything else just fade into background noise. It's the only way for me to remain true to the world of All Souls and keep creating the original, fresh stories that people want to read.
The scope of the All Souls world is complicated, to put it mildly. How do you keep a handle on all the different threads? Do you have a massive database or a photographic memory? Or both?
I do have a photographic memory, as it turns out. I also have a very sharp memory, one that's been tuned by working for more than 20 years as a historian. In history, you always have to balance out detailed information with the big picture. That skill's come in very handy for me as a novelist, especially a novelist who's built up an alternate world with a slightly different set of natural laws, historical narratives, and cultural traditions. I also do have a database and two wonderful helpers, Lisa Haltonen and Jill Huff, who know how to look things up in it when I need to know what car somebody drove or when Matthew was last in Italy. Both Lisa and Jill have advanced degrees and excellent memories, too, and they help keep the story and this writer on course.
You've said that music is as essential to your writing as breathing, and you've shared many of the playlists you listened to when you wrote the trilogy. Can you describe how you construct your musical playlists? What comes first, the playlist or the writing?
The playlists sort of construct themselves. Sometimes I'm driving in the car and I hear a song on shuffle and it just strikes me, that's a Matthew song or that's a Diana song. Sometimes these insights are linked to a particular moment, but often it's just a general character feeling. Other times there's a line in a song that inspires me. Kate Bush's Waking the Witch, for instance, made me think about all the ways that Diana was asleep before her magic became unbound.
Bringing to life the characters of All Souls. Diana is such a unique character, strong, independent, and vulnerable too. There are striking parallels between Diana's life and your own. How much does she reflect you and your experience?
Certainly the fact that Diana is a historian and working at the Bodleian was something I knew, although I must say that what historians actually do in a day is not always how it seems in books. A lot of Diana's character detail simply came from putting her in a particular situation and imagining what someone with her background and characteristics would do. From that perspective, Diana often does things I would never do because she's not me.
Diana is a reluctant witch who gradually learns to embrace her power. This seems to have resonated with many of your readers. Why did you choose to tell this particular story, one about a reluctant witch?
I just don't find it believable to think that if you were gifted with enormous power, you'd be happy about it. I see too many people who are afraid of their talents, their skills, voice, their ideas, never mind wielding supernatural abilities.
How did the mysterious Matthew Claremont take shape in your head?
Back when I started A Discovery of Witches and was first imagining this story about an ancient vampire scientist and a reluctant witch, I thought, wouldn't it be fun if my vampire was someone who really lived, someone mysterious who knew interesting people but remained in the shadows? I knew of just such a person in Elizabethan England, the poet spy Matthew Royden. From that moment on, and this was in 2008, so it was some time ago, Matthew Royden's life story determined a great deal about Matthew Claremont's intellectual habits and his taste in friends. A historical figure like Matthew Royden is a novelist's dream because what little we know about him is so fascinating, and it leaves so much room for creative invention.
Ashmole 782 is a core character in the novels alongside Diana and Matthew. And the trilogy is a story of books as much as of creatures. Did you find that Ashmole 782 took on a life of its own as you began writing? Or was it fully formed from the beginning?
Like most of my characters, Ashmole 782 grew and changed over the course of the writing. There's not much information to go on about this real historical character, so I was able to imagine a book into being. That was an exciting process.
How difficult was it to recreate real historical characters you've spent years researching into a fictional context? Did you already have clear voices for Elizabeth I, Kit Marlowe, Walter Riley, Mary Sidney, and others?
I usually have some sense of a character based on the texts they read or wrote, some of which I've been studying for decades. That familiarity makes me react strongly to the pop culturing of historical characters in books and other media. Some treatments of these individuals make them either cuddly or monsters. Most were neither. They were just doing the best they could in a challenging world. That said, I don't usually work out full character sketches in advance. The fine details of the characters emerge as I put them in specific situations. So Henry Percy's mother and her goose came about because I started wondering what kind of Christmas the Earl of Northumberland would have enjoyed growing up, which led me to research his mother, who turned out to be quite a character. The historical character I knew best was probably Elizabeth I. I wrote my master's thesis on how Elizabeth I relied on the symbolism surrounding the goddess Diana, both the virgin huntress and the wilder, witchier side of the goddess, to bolster her own power. I've been fascinated by Elizabeth Tudor since I was a teenager, studied her life and her reign throughout my undergraduate education and into my graduate school training. She's a fixture of my teaching now that I'm a professor. Reading her personal writings each year with my students gives me fresh insights into her character and her voice. Even after 40 years, however, Elizabeth still manages to be elusive. I'm not sure I'm ever going to figure her out.
Everyone loves Matthew and Diana, but other characters who are not always at center stage are equally popular, including Galloglass, Philippe, Isabeau, and Marcus. If you had to pick one, who would be your favorite in the trilogy?
Philippe de Clermont, without question. He's the access of the All Souls universe, the still point in the center around which the whole story turns. Without Philippe, there would be no story. It's odd to have the main character in the trilogy appear only briefly in the second volume, but his placement in the arc of the story actually underscores how central he is to the narrative.
What was the toughest thing you've had to do to a character when you were writing the books?
The toughest thing was being honest about Matthew's dark and deceitful side. He is not a standard hero. He truly does have rough edges and prejudices that make him not just annoying and troublesome, but dangerous and problematic. I like Matthew, so there's always a temptation to smooth him out and make him more affable and appealing. That can be hard to resist.
Did any of your characters surprise you as you were writing?
All of them did. But the biggest surprises came from the appearance of Hamish and Galloglass. I know that sounds silly. How could I be surprised if I'm the author? But I had no plans for Matthew to have a best friend when I began, and certainly no idea he had such a fabulous nephew. In the case of Hamish, I actually left my office and shouted down the hall, "Matthew is in a car. He's driving. I don't know where." I soon found out he was going to visit his demonic friend Hamish. As for Galloglass, I was writing the scene in the old lodge's great hall and was feeling a bit peevish, really, about Kit and Matthew's behavior, when suddenly the door to the hall burst open, a blast of damp air came in, and Galloglass arrived with it. Once he was in the story, I simply could not get him out of it again. It meant stopping everything for 3 weeks and figuring out who this Gale was and what role he had in the story. But I think it was worth it.
From Oxford to Auvergne, Madison and New Haven to Venice, the characters in the trilogy traveled to incredible locations throughout the world. Have you been to all the places featured in the books?
As a writer, I really need to experience the places I write about in my books. I want to know what they smell like, how the air feels when it changes direction, the way the sunlight strikes the windowsill in the morning, the sound of the birds and the insects. Not every writer may require this, but I do. That's why I spent time in New Haven, undertaking research at the Beinecke Library, so I could understand the rhythms of Diana's day there. I visited New Orleans several times to imagine my vampires into that city. All the locations I pick are steeped in history and stories about past inhabitants, perfect fuel for any writer's creative fire.
Your historical research is woven in effortlessly to create the fabric of the All Souls world. How difficult did you find it to balance all that you know of the 16th century with writing fiction? How important is historical accuracy to you in the details of your fictional writing?
Historical accuracy is very important to me for obvious reasons. I like to stick to the sources as closely as possible, and I try never to violate them. But historical accuracy isn't always the same as historical truth. Not all sources survive, and we have few reflective writings from the early modern and medieval periods, so historians are wary of asserting how people thought and felt. Obviously, thinking and feeling are quite important when you're writing a novel. I've spent decades reading and studying the available sources for the period, and there are aspects of life in the past that I may have a feeling about, but there are no sources to back up those feelings. As a historian, I can't do much with gut feelings. As a novelist, however, I can tell what I believe to be historically true, even if I don't have source materials. As for balancing out historical information with fiction, I found that a little historical information goes a long way. I can, for instance, spend 3 pages describing a 16th century table, but I have to ask myself, if this story was set in modern times, would I spend 3 pages describing a table? Usually, the answer is no. So I try to use the historical information like seasoning in a stew and sprinkle it in rather than just dumping it.
How important were these gaps in the historical record when it came to plotting out Diana and Matthew's story?
All those frustrating silences that aggravate me as a historian turned out to be perfect opportunities for me as a novelist. The fact that there's very little hard factual information on Matthew Royden, for instance, gave me the perfect chance to craft Matthew's Elizabethan backstory. The legends about witches raising a wind to keep James VI of Scotland and Denmark provided me with a way to dramatize the perils that might befall witches who meddled in human politics.
You have had your own experience of uncovering a mysterious lost manuscript in an old library. Could you tell us the story behind your discovery and how that inspired the trilogy?
I did discover a manuscript. Not an enchanted one, alas, in the Bodleian Library. It was a manuscript owned by Queen Elizabeth's astrologer, the mathematician and alchemist John Dee. In the 1570s and 1580s, he became interested in using a crystal ball to talk to angels. The angels gave him all kinds of instructions on how to manage his life at home, his work. They even told him to pack up his family and belongings and go to faraway Poland and Prague. In the conversations, Dee asked the angels about a mysterious book in his library called the Book of Soiga, or Alderaya. No one had ever been able to find it, even though many of Dee's other books survive in libraries throughout the world. In the summer of 1994, I was spending time in Oxford between finishing my doctorate and starting my first job. It was a wonderfully creative time for me, because I had no deadlines to worry about and my dissertation on Dee's angel conversations was complete. As with most discoveries, this discovery of a lost manuscript was entirely accidental. I was looking for something else in the Bodleian's catalog, and in the upper corner of the page was a reference to a book called Alderaya. I knew it couldn't be Dee's book, but I called it up anyway, and it turned out it was the book, or at least a copy of it. With the help of the Bodleian's Keeper of Rare Books, I located another copy in the British Library.
The significance of family and community emerges as a core theme in the trilogy. Was this something that was important to you in creating Diana and Matthew's world?
Since time immemorial, the family has been an important way for people to organize themselves in the world. In the past, the traditional family was a sprawling and blended unit that embraced close relatives, in-laws, and their immediate families, servants, orphan children, the children your partner might bring into a family from a previous relationship, and all sorts of other dependents. Marriage was an equally flexible and elastic concept in many places and times. Given how old my vampires are, and the fact that witches are the keepers of tradition, I wanted to explore from the very first page of the series the truly traditional basis of family, which is unqualified love and mutual responsibility. That's certainly the meaning of family that my parents taught me.
The conflicts between creatures in the trilogy mirror many divisions of race and sexuality in our own societies. What ideas do you hope readers will come away with from exploring these issues through the fantasy world you've created?
Human beings like to sort and categorize. We have done this since the beginning of recorded history and probably well back beyond that point. One of the most common ways to do so is to group things that are alike and things that are different. I think we have a very complicated relationship to creatures and people who aren't like us. On the one hand, we're enormously attracted to them. We're fascinated by them. We want to know more. But often we fear what is not like us. Many of the world's ills have stemmed from someone or a group of someone's deciding that what is different is also dangerous. Witches, women, people of color, people of different faiths, people of different sexual orientations, all have been targets of this process of singling others out and labeling them different and therefore undesirable. Like my interest in exploring what a family is, the issue of difference and respect for difference rather than fear informed every page of the All Souls trilogy. And yes, I do think that dealing with fantastic creatures like demons, vampires, and witches, rather than confronting issues of race or sexuality directly, can enable readers to think through these issues in a useful way and perhaps come to different conclusions about members of their own families and communities. As I often say when people ask me why supernatural creatures are so popular these days, witches and vampires are monsters to think with.
One of the things that make the All Souls world-building so vivid is the way in which you use genetics to create a scientific explanation for the supernatural. You are a historian of science, but not a scientist. How did you ensure you were getting the science correct?
I did a lot of reading about genetics and different theories about chromosomal change, and I read studies of spontaneous chromosomal mutations due to pathogen bombardments. It seemed to me that there were all kinds of wonderful possible explanations in the scientific world for creature differentiation, so that's the explanation I went with. For me, the world of the trilogy needed to make some sense in our modern scientific perspective. I realized that modern genetic research would be a problem. The various species were once differentiated from humans because they could make certain things happen or had a dissimilar diet. Today, however, being admitted to the hospital after a car accident and having their blood tested might result in discovery. This could be enormously frightening to individuals, but could also offer the prospect of real understanding between species. As an aside, I also think that alchemy fed into my combination of fantasy and science, because alchemy is a scientific discipline positing that substances can change fundamentally from one thing to another. Alchemy has a rich set of images and beliefs about how a seed can turn into a plant, or lead can turn into gold, or the mortal can change into the immortal. So I began to wonder, well, how was neuroscience, like magic, or neutron bombardment, like alchemy? Those were really fun days when big conceptual pieces of the worldview puzzle began to fall into place. In the end, I hope readers come to appreciate that science, past or present, is nothing more than a method for asking and answering questions about the world and our place in it. Once, some of these questions were answered alchemically. Today, they might be answered biochemically and genetically. In the future, who knows? But Matthew is right in suggesting that there are really remarkably few scientific questions, and we've been posing them for a very long time. Two of them are these: who am I, and why am I here?
The magic is as real and powerful as science in the trilogy. With alchemy as the intersection of the two, how else did you approach theories of magic to ensure its position as equal to science in the All Souls world?
Believe it or not, my inspiration for weaving came from a branch of mathematics called topology. I became intrigued by mathematical theories of mutability to go along with my alchemical theories of mutability and change. Topology is a mathematical study of shapes and spaces that theorizes how far something can be stretched or twisted without breaking. You could say it's a mathematical theory of connectivity and continuity, two familiar themes to any reader of the All Souls trilogy. I wondered if I could come up with a theory of magic that could be comfortably contained within mathematics, one in which magic could be seen to shape and twist reality without breaking it. I used fabric as a metaphor for this worldview, with threads and colors shaping human perceptions. Weavers became the witches who were talented at seeing and manipulating the underlying fabric. In topology, mathematicians study knots, unbreakable knots, with their ends fused together that can be twisted and shaped. Soon, the mathematics and mechanics of Diana's magic came into focus.
Readers all over the globe have embraced the world and characters you've created. What has been your reaction to the outpouring of love for the All Souls trilogy?
It's been amazing. I was surprised by how quickly readers embraced two central characters who have a considerable number of quirks and who challenged our typical notion of what a heroine or a hero should be. And I frankly continue to be amazed whenever a new reader pops up, whether one in the United States or somewhere like Finland or Japan, to tell me how much she enjoyed being caught up in the world of the Bishops and de Clermonts. Sometimes when I meet readers, they ask me how their friends are doing, meaning Diana or Matthew or Miriam. That's an extraordinary experience for any writer.
Synopses. A discovery of witches. Diana Bishop is a reluctant witch from a long line of distinguished witches. Her ancestor, Bridget Bishop, was hanged for the practice of witchcraft in Salem in 1692. And Diana's parents, both powerful witches, were mysteriously murdered when she was 7. As a result, Diana wants nothing to do with witchcraft or magic. Instead, she studies the history of science with a focus on alchemy. By the age of 33, she is a tenured professor at Yale University and safely removed from the world of magic. In September 2009, Diana is visiting Oxford University in England. At the Bodleian Library, Diana requests an alchemical manuscript, Ashmole 782, that once belonged to the 17th century book collector and alchemist Elias Ashmole. It contains strange illustrations and is obviously enchanted, with a hidden layer of words shimmering under its surface. The first 3 pages have been removed. Puzzled but reluctant to be involved with magic, Diana returns the manuscript to the stacks. Soon, Diana is being followed. Though most humans don't know it, they share the world with 3 other types of creatures. Witches, who have supernatural powers. Vampires, preternaturally powerful, who drink blood in order to survive. And demons, who can be brilliantly creative, but also prone to madness. Chief among the creatures seeking her out is Matthew Clermont, a professor of biochemistry at Oxford, and a vampire. Matthew has been looking for Ashmole 782 since Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species was published in 1859. Matthew had heard about another book that supposedly explained the origin of demons, witches, and vampires. When he searched Ashmole's library collection in 1859, however, the book was missing. The general wisdom is that humans, vampires, witches, and demons are separate species, but Matthew believes they may share a common ancestor. In his laboratory, Matthew and his vampire assistants, Miriam Shepherd and Marcus Whitmore, study mitochondrial DNA to trace creature origins. Matthew is afraid that non-human creatures are becoming extinct. Modern witches have fewer children, demons exhibit less genius and more madness, and vampires have trouble creating new vampires. Vampires create vampires by draining the blood of humans and substituting their own. A recent series of murders involving bloodless corpses suggests that the process is failing. Against Matthew's objections, Diana provides a blood sample to be analyzed to aid their work. Matthew and Diana soon begin falling in love. They decide that Diana will call the manuscript again, but when she tries, the library tells her that it has been missing for 150 years. Diana has no idea how to retrieve it. She has never been adept at the basics of witchcraft, and has little knowledge of her powers. Other creatures want Ashmole 782 as well. The witch, Peter Knox, believes that Ashmole 782 contains information on the first spells ever constructed, the secret of immortality, and how vampires can be destroyed forever. He thinks it belongs exclusively to the witches. The demon, Agatha Wilson, explains that demons want it because it might reveal where they came from and why they exist. The bickering over who owns Ashmole 782 highlights the prejudices that underlie creature relationships. Fellow witch Gillian Chamberlain warns Diana of the dangers of disloyalty, revealing that Diana's parents were killed by their own kind for keeping secrets. These prejudices echo the opinions of Diana's aunt, Sarah Bishop. Sarah and her partner, Emily Mather, raised Diana after her parents' death. Matthew gradually shares some of his secrets with Diana, including the fact that he is 1,500 years old. To his demon friend, Hamish Osborne, he confesses that during his long life, he has killed two women he loved through lack of control. Matthew is afraid he might harm Diana as well. Diana instinctively trusts Matthew Claremont, however. When a photo of her slaughtered parents is planted in her rooms at Oxford, a warning that the witches will stop at nothing to get hold of Ashmole 782, Diana and Matthew travel to the Auvergne in France to hide out at his family's ancient castle, Sept Tours. Its only current residents are his mother, Isabeau, and her housekeeper, Marthe, both vampires. Unfortunately, Isabeau despises witches because her vampire husband, Philippe, was killed by witches in collaboration with the Nazis during World War II. And the atmosphere is tense. At Sept Tours, Diana and Matthew grow closer. With Matthew's help, she realizes she has been using magic almost daily without realizing it. And the results of Diana's DNA profile show that she has more potential for magic than Matthew's lab has ever seen in one witch, including control over all the four elements and abilities for mind reading, flight, and talking with the dead. Suddenly, Domenico Michel, an old vampire adversary of Matthew's, comes to Sept Tours. As a result, Diana learns about the Covenant, an agreement forged among vampires, witches, and demons during the Crusades. The Covenant forbids non-human creatures to associate with creatures of other types. The purpose is ostensibly to protect them from human discovery. Any creature that breaks the Covenant is subject to punishment by the Congregation, a council of nine creatures, three vampires, three witches, three demons. After Domenico's visit, Matthew declares that he and Diana must end their relationship. He is frightened of what other witches and vampires might do to her, and of his own violent tendencies. Diana declares that she loves him and refuses to leave. Then Matthew is notified that there has been an attempt to break into his research lab, and he returns to Oxford. Diana's frustration at Matthew's departure sets off a bout of weeping that turns to witch water. Her tears fill the tower and threaten to dissolve her. Isabeau pulls her back to the world by singing in a beautiful, unearthly voice. Afterward, Isabeau tells Diana the story of Matthew's human death, that he was found dying at the bottom of a tower, a suspected suicide, shortly after the death of his wife and child. Isabeau made him a vampire to save him from the fear of being in hell for eternity, separated from his human family. In Matthew's absence, Isabeau takes Diana hunting to put her off having a vampire as a husband. Diana wins Isabeau's grudging admiration by watching her hunt animals for blood without flinching. While working alone in Matthew's study, Diana discovers that he belongs to a secret group called the Knights of Lazarus, which succeeded the Knights Templar in 1313. The Knights of Lazarus have bankrolled an astonishing array of historical events, from paying off Elizabeth I's debts to purchasing most of the factories in Manchester in the 19th century. Matthew wields more power than she had ever dreamed possible. Matthew returns to Sept Tours and tells Diana he loves her. After they kiss, Matthew declares, "We are one, from this moment forward." Diana doesn't fully understand it at the time, but this is the beginning of a vampire's formal mating process. The female selects her mate, and once he has agreed, they are mated. Isabeau accepts Diana as her daughter. Matthew reveals that Diana's rooms at Oxford were broken into as well, probably by witches looking for her hair and fingernails to use in spells. The hair and fingernails might reveal traces of DNA, too. He now believes that the Congregation would be threatening Diana, even if she and Matthew weren't breaking the Covenant. That the Congregation's real interest lies in using Diana to acquire Ashmole 782. Matthew finally joins Diana in her bed, though they don't completely consummate the relationship. The next morning, a Finnish witch named Satu Järvinen flies into the garden and kidnaps Diana. She carries Diana to the castle of La Pierre, where Domenico and Gébert d'Aurillac, a vampire and former pope, are waiting. Satu sends them away and tortures Diana for hours, using an opening spell on her to force her to reveal information about Ashmole 782. But Diana remembers her mother's long-ago injunctions to keep secrets, and she remains silent. Isabeau sends for Matthew's vampire brother, Baldwin, who is an excellent tracker and strategist. Shortly after, Baldwin and Matthew are headed to La Pierre in a helicopter. Satu has thrown Diana into a deep dungeon called an oubliette, while she flies off to ask other witches for help in forcing out Diana's secrets. In the oubliette, a dazed Diana sees the ghosts of her parents, and her mother repeats a story she used to tell the 7-year-old Diana about being bound by ribbons. The ribbons symbolize being spellbound, or stripped of her magical power. Spellbinding is usually performed only on witches who have used magic to do something terrible, but Diana's parents spellbound her for her own protection, to hide her power from other creatures. Diana's mother encourages her to throw off the ribbons and use her powers to escape. Diana manages to do so, lifting herself up from the bottom of the pit and steering toward Matthew and her freedom. Matthew, Diana, and Baldwin return to Sept Tour, and Matthew tends to Diana's wounds. It's imperative that she learn to use her magic to protect herself. So the next day, Baldwin accompanies Matthew and Diana to New York to seek help from her aunts in the town of Madison. There, Diana realizes that the mark Satu made on her back formed the seal of the Knights of Lazarus, a star hung above a crescent moon. Not only has Satu branded Diana as Matthew's property, she has made it clear that the witches know that the de Clermont family are the heads of the Knights of Lazarus. On Diana and Matthew's third day in Madison, the Bishop House, which has a mind of its own, slams the keeping room doors to capture their attention and summon all to a meeting. An envelope shoots out of the keeping room paneling. It contains one of the missing pages from Ashmole 782, a note from Diana's mother, and a piece of paper saying, "It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches." Rebecca Bishop's note explains that the page from Ashmole 782, along with the other piece of paper, arrived when Diana was 3 years old. Diana now realizes that a penciled inscription she saw on the Ashmole 782 manuscript was written by her father. Sarah explains that Stephen Proctor was a time walker, and they theorize that he traveled back to 1859 to bewitch Ashmole 782, so that only Diana could open it. Sarah reveals that Diana herself time-walked as a toddler. The page from Ashmole 782 depicts the chemical wedding, conjunctio. This is a crucial step in making the Philosopher's Stone, the alchemical key to riches and eternal life. The golden-haired queen in the illustration seems to represent Diana, and the king is pale and dark-haired like Matthew. Miriam Shepherd, who has arrived from England with Marcus Whitmore, points out that the next step in the alchemical process is conceptio. Miriam believes that Ashmole 782 is about creature reproduction, and that vampires and witches, as well as other mixed partners, might be able to have children together. Miriam and Marcus have more information about Diana's DNA. She is a chimera, a person with cells that possesses two or more different genetic profiles. Since one of the genetic profiles is male, the likeliest explanation is vanishing twin syndrome. Her twin brother was miscarried in the womb, and Diana absorbed his genetic material. Marcus points out that because Diana has already absorbed foreign DNA into her body and is a universal blood recipient, AB positive, she is less apt to reject a fetus that is half vampire. This represents a threat to the foundation of the covenant. Sarah and Matthew both try without success to help Diana learn to use her powers. One day when Matthew is stalking Diana in the woods to try to force her to use magic to defend herself, they encounter the vampire Juliette Durand, a former lover of Matthew's. Gébert had created her centuries ago to steal Matthew's secrets. This time he has sent her to kill Matthew and take Diana to face the congregation. Diana's magical instincts take over, and she kills Juliette with bolts of witchfire, but only after Juliette has mortally wounded Matthew. Diana begs the goddess to help her save Matthew's life, promising anything in return. The goddess accepts, and Diana allows Matthew to drink her blood saving his life. Clearly, Diana and Matthew need a safer place to hide. Time walking to the past is the answer, since the congregation can't follow them there, and the past holds more powerful witches to serve as tutors to Diana. Time walking to the past requires three objects from the exact time and place the witch is traveling to, however. As the group is discussing this challenge, Agatha Wilson's son, Nathaniel, and his wife, Sophie Norman, both demons, arrive. Sophie is pregnant with a witch, and Agatha has urged her to see Diana. Agatha knows that her grandchild will be in danger once the congregation realizes she is an exception to their beliefs about creature reproduction. Sophie presents Diana with a silver chess piece that Sophie's family has been passing down for generations, along with a message. When the time comes, give it to the one who has need of it. Matthew recognizes it as a piece he had lost in a wager on All Souls Night many centuries before. Shortly afterward, the house ejects a witch's poppet from the paneling, containing an earring that belonged to Isabu. Matthew confirms that this earring was in the same place as the chess piece on the night of the wager. This convinces him of the location and time to which they must time walk, though he shares the information with no one. Matthew asks Hamish Osborne to bring him the third object, a holograph manuscript of Christopher Marlowe's play, Dr. Faustus. Hamish also brings paperwork regarding the Knights of Lazarus. Anticipating war with the congregation, Matthew appoints his son, Marcus Whitmore, Grand Master in his place, and gives his blessing for Nathaniel Wilson to become a knight. As Halloween night approaches, Nathaniel, Sophie, Marcus, Miriam, Sarah, and Emily leave the house in Madison. They will reconvene at Septour with Isabeau and Marthe. Sophie refers to the group as a conventicle, a gathering of dissenters. Alone in the house, Matthew and Diana gather their three objects. At last, Matthew reveals their destination, his house in Oxfordshire, on October 31st, 1590. Diana imagines the sights and smells of 1590, and they begin their journey. Shortly afterward, Sarah and Emily return one last time to the empty house, where Matthew has left Sarah a clue as to where and when he and Diana have gone. A small book and a note. The note reads, "Don't worry. We made it." The book is George Chapman's The Shadow of Night, dated 1594. Shadow of Night. Matthew de Clermont and Diana Bishop arrive at Matthew's house in Woodstock, England, on October 31st, 1590. Diana is introduced to Matthew's friends, playwright and demon Christopher Marlowe, human poet George Chapman, demon astronomer Thomas Harriot, human adventurer Sir Walter Raleigh, and human Henry Percy, 9th Earl of Northumberland. These are the members of what will one day be known as the School of Night. Matthew has a different name here, Matthew Royden. Matthew's friends already know that he is a vampire. He tells them that Diana is a witch, and that they've traveled from the future because their relationship has put them in danger from the congregation. Most are happy to help, but Marlowe is recalcitrant because he is jealous of Diana's relationship with Matthew. Diana wants to learn to pass as an Elizabethan gentlewoman, and she practices Elizabethan penmanship in her journal. Matthew is keen to fetch a witch immediately to help Diana understand her powers, though the outbreak of witch hunts has made witches wary of strangers. The meeting with a local witch ends badly. Matthew antagonizes Widow Beaton, and she leaves convinced that Diana is in league with the devil. Two new vampires arrive, Matthew's nephew, Galloglass, and his companion, Davy Hancock. The two men were alarmed when Matthew failed to meet them on November 1st as planned. With witch hunts going on in Berwick, Scotland, Galloglass and Hancock feared that Matthew had gone there on royal business and come to harm. The 1590 Matthew, Diana learns, is not only a spy for Queen Elizabeth I, but also a member of the congregation. Philippe, Matthew's vampire stepfather, knows of Matthew's disappearance and has demanded that he come to the family home in France. In the 21st century, Philippe is dead, and Matthew is agonized at the thought of seeing him again. Matthew must comply, however, or Philippe will endanger his own life by coming to England. Before they leave, Diana sets her journal on a shelf in the library. In November 2009, archivist Rima Ayen, at the Gonsalves Archives in Seville, Spain, comes across Diana's journal in a forgotten box in the archive attics. The page that bears Diana's name has been ripped out, but Rima feels that the book is important. Her boss, however, discourages her idea to share images of the journal with colleagues in the United Kingdom. Matthew and Diana travel to Septour and tell Matthew's imposing father their story of finding Ashmole 782, falling in love, and traveling back to 1590. Philippe wants to know why Matthew couldn't ask him for help in the future, and Matthew admits that in their future, Philippe is dead. Philippe disapproves of Matthew and Diana's relationship, which he knows will cause war. He also knows their union is not irrevocable because it has not been physically consummated. Nevertheless, Philippe shelters Matthew and Diana on the condition that they stay in separate rooms. Matthew wants to leave immediately, but Diana insists on remaining. One day, Philippe suggests that Diana follow Matthew on his daily visits to the village church so she can come to know him better. There, Matthew confesses his guilt over committing suicide. Worse, he admits that he is the one who killed Philippe. Torture by the Nazis drove Philippe to madness, and he begged his family to end his pain. Philippe's death was an act of mercy, but Matthew is still racked with guilt. Philippe deduces that Matthew feels guilty for killing him in the future, but believes that Matthew must have done it during a fit of blood rage, a blood-borne illness that can cause a vampire to kill without reason. He challenges Matthew to a fight to drive him into a blood rage and lower his defenses. Once Matthew has returned to his senses, Philippe forgives him for what he will do. Knowing that Matthew is currently in no shape to defend himself and Diana against the congregation, Philippe adopts Diana as his blood-sworn daughter. The next day, a powerful witch named André Champier arrives in response to Philippe's earlier request for a witch to tutor Diana. To learn Diana's secrets, Champier announces he will extract her memories by the root, leaving her mind blank. When Philippe fails to intervene, Diana reaches for Philippe's knife and thrusts it into Champier's heart, killing him. Philippe reveals that he has been testing Diana and Matthew since they first arrived. Diana has accepted Matthew's flaws and his blood rage, and murdered a fellow witch to avoid revealing any de Clermont family secrets. Philippe is satisfied and announces that they are ready to marry. Matthew and Diana are married at the village church, and that night they physically consummate their relationship. In the following days, Diana grows closer to both Matthew and Philippe. Philippe confides to her his and Isabeau's game of hiding notes for each other inside books, and he tucks one of these notes into a copy of the Aurora Consurgens. Then Philippe receives a message that Champier's friends are coming to Septour to look for him. On Christmas Day, Matthew and Diana leave Septour and begin the journey back to England. Back in 2009, Isabeau knows that Matthew and Diana have traveled to 1590 and is sure that Philippe would have sent her word about them. She finds the note he'd hidden in the Aurora Consurgens. Philippe writes that he has seen Matthew and Diana and hints at the possibility of grandchildren. Isabeau tells Sarah and Emily that Philippe is certain that the different species of non-human creatures can procreate together. The women know that having a child would place Matthew and Diana in great danger from the congregation, in both the past and the present. A time-walking witch might even be able to follow them there. They agree to watch for any historical anomalies that Matthew and Diana might trigger, so that their presence in the 16th century can be kept a secret. Matthew and Diana arrive at their inn in the Blackfriars on Christmas Eve. In 1590, England and France operated on separate calendars, causing a 10-day time difference and giving the couple the rare opportunity to celebrate the holidays twice. Matthew and Diana also learn that she is pregnant. Matthew wants to return to the present at once, but Diana reminds him that she doesn't know how to use the necessary spells. She still needs a witch. They contact Mary Sidney, the Countess of Pembroke, and a good friend of Matthew's, to see if she has any leads. Mary has religious objections to magic and cannot recommend a witch, but she invites Diana to help with her alchemical experiments. She also warns Diana that Matthew is being watched, so Diana determines to find a witch herself. Diana goes out into the city to draw the attention of other witches. Instead, she is noticed by the vampire Father Hubbard, the self-styled ruler of all non-human creatures in the city of London. Hubbard requires that all newcomers become his children through a blood